Imagine a massive pharmaceutical plant, right? Producing life-saving insulin. And overnight, a local transit strike just wipes out like 80% of its workforce.
Which is a complete operational nightmare.
Exactly. Yet somehow, 48 hours later, production hasn't dropped a single vial, and quality is completely flawless. How is that even physically possible?
It sounds like magic, but it's really highly structured logistics.
Right. I mean, you might think factory staffing is just, you know, an administrative HR headache. But when a disruption hits, this is the exact system that decides whether there's food on your grocery store shelves or medicine in your pharmacy.
Yeah, we fundamentally misunderstand how the products we rely on keep flowing during a crisis. We tend to assume there's just, well, a deep bench of workers waiting in the wings to step in.
Like understudies in a play or something.
Right. But emergency staffing is an entirely different operational discipline. It's built around three core pillars, which are urgency, risk exposure, and operational consequence.
Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're doing a deep dive into the invisible safety net that keeps the global supply chain from completely collapsing when a factory floor suddenly empties out.
Which is such a fascinating topic.
It really is. We're looking at a detailed internal briefing on emergency staffing for production facilities. So we're not just talking about, you know, calling a local agency to cover a few holiday shifts or a maternity leave.
Oh, far from it. Routine staffing assumes you have weeks to source candidates for predictable vacancies.
Yeah.
Emergency staffing is, well, it's field triage for a supply chain.
Triage is a great word for it.
Yeah. You aren't trying to perform a scheduled surgery or optimize the patient. You are applying a tourniquet so the operational heart keeps beating.
Just keeping the lights on.
Exactly. You're trying to stabilize production without accidentally creating secondary disasters in safety, quality, or compliance.
I mean, I grasp how a sudden catastrophic event like a hurricane triggers that triage mode. The physical plant shuts down, people are evacuated.
Right, the obvious emergencies.
Yeah, but looking at the mechanics of production in this document, a massive natural disaster isn't the only threat, is it? Like, a completely normal Tuesday can just silently unravel into a staffing emergency.
What's fascinating here is that the most dangerous disruptions aren't always the visible ones.
Really?
Yeah. A sudden strike or a regional power grid failure is obvious. But a facility can quietly lose its stability long before it officially fails. We see this with localized transportation interruptions, sudden absenteeism spikes, or even aggressive, unforecasted product surges, like when a massive order hits the floor unannounced.
Oh, it's the slow tire leak phenomenon.
Exactly, the slow leak.
Like, you don't hit a tree at 60 miles an hour, you just slowly lose tire pressure. You compensate by gripping the steering wheel tighter, leaning into the drift, maybe ignoring that faint thumping sound.
And hoping you make it to the next exit.
Right. And eventually you're driving on the rim, sparking down the highway, but the failure actually started miles ago.
The factory floor experiences that exact same mechanical drift. Say a local bridge closure delays a dozen workers. Supervisors who are just trying to keep the line moving pull inexperienced people from other departments to plug those specific holes.
Which seems like a logical quick fix.
It does. But because those inexperienced workers are slower, standard maintenance windows get compressed or skipped entirely to make up for lost time.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Quality control checks get abbreviated. Your core experienced employees start absorbing massive amounts of overtime.
Which inevitably leads to physical and cognitive fatigue.
Right. And the real danger is psychological. Those small deviations become completely normalized.
In new normal.
Exactly. The plant managers become so hyper-focused on the output metrics, like just getting the pallets out the loading dock, that they are completely blind to the operational degradation. They don't realize their safety margins have evaporated.
So they don't even know they're in trouble yet.
That represents the invisible tipping point. Emergency staffing becomes necessary exactly when labor scarcity forces a change in how the facility operates.
That makes total sense.
The moment a plant compromises its standard operating procedures just to hit a production quota, it has entered an emergency state. The crisis isn't impending. It has already arrived.
So, okay, the managers finally realize they are driving on the rim. The line is bleeding efficiency. They need, say, 50 people by midnight. Why not just pick up the phone, call a massive national temp agency, and demand a 50-person headcount?
Because standard staffing models mathematically cannot support that timeline or those stakes.
They're just too slow.
Way too slow. A traditional agency requires weeks to build a requisition, source candidates, run background checks, and schedule staggered onboarding.
Right.
Emergency staffing compresses a 6-week deployment cycle into 48 hours, or sometimes even 12 hours.
Wow, 12 hours.
Yeah, that requires coordinating charter transportation, securing block hotel lodging, expedited credentialing, and site orientation in literally a matter of hours.
Wait, I have a massive problem with this premise, though.
Okay, what is it?
If you are rushing busloads of strangers into an active industrial environment, heavy machinery, powered industrial trucks, high voltage equipment, within hours of their arrival, aren't you just begging for a catastrophic injury?
It sounds incredibly risky, yes.
I mean, how can anyone physically enforce safety protocols on 50 people who don't even know the layout of the building?
That tension right there is the core operational paradox we see in the source. Speed versus safety.
Right.
A facility needs instantaneous labor to survive, but deploying underprepared workers into a high-risk zone can literally shut the plant down faster than having no workers at all.
So how do they solve it?
The structural solution to this is modular onboarding.
Modular onboarding, meaning you don't even try to teach them the standard employee manual.
You discard the standard manual entirely.
Yeah, completely.
Completely. A full orientation covers company history, benefits, comprehensive machine operation, and, you know, long-term continuous improvement strategies.
Right, the typical corporate stuff.
Yeah. A crisis worker won't retain any of that, and trying to teach it just creates cognitive overload. Modular onboarding on shift one is strictly about physical survival and environmental control.
So you're just drawing a hard physical box around what they can and cannot do.
Exactly. The briefing covers emergency exits, mandatory personal protective equipment, direct reporting lines, and absolute task boundaries.
Okay, but to address my concern about enforcing this, how do you actually make sure they stay in that box?
Facilities use immediate visual management. Emergency workers are issued high-visibility vests of a specific color, say, bright orange, while core employees wear yellow.
Oh, that's smart.
Right. And certain restricted zones, like the chemical mixing area or heavy stamping presses, are physically taped off or require specialized proximity keycards.
So you can literally see who belongs where.
Exactly. A supervisor standing on a catwalk can look down and instantly see if an orange vest has drifted into a restricted zone. The control is environmental, not just theoretical.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Getting workers safely onto the floor is only half the battle.
Right, because they actually have to do the work.
Yeah, you have to guarantee that the actual product they are handling isn't ruined. I was thinking, bringing temporary labor into a highly tuned production environment is sort of like letting a stranger cook a complex meal in my kitchen.
That's a great analogy. They might have the fundamental cooking skills, but they lack the environmental context.
Think about the mechanics of it. A professional chef could walk into my kitchen, but they don't know that my specific oven runs, you know, 20 degrees hot on the left side.
Right.
Or that my refrigerator door requires a specific physical hip check to actually seal. Without that intimate knowledge of the space, even a skilled person will burn the roast or spoil the milk.
And in manufacturing, that environmental context is known as tacit knowledge.
Tacit knowledge?
Yeah. Experienced workers possess a massive reservoir of undocumented sensory understanding of their civic facility.
Like muscle memory almost.
Exactly. A 10-year veteran on a packaging line knows that when the primary compressor makes a high-pitched whining sound, the seal on the plastic film is going to be weak 10 minutes later.
Wow.
Or they know when a raw material feels slightly too damp just by touching it. Temporary workers, regardless of their general competency, simply cannot possess that facility-specific sensory judgment.
Which means treating emergency labor as a simple numerical replacement is essentially an operational death sentence.
Absolutely.
You can't just say, we are short 5 machine operators, put these 5 bust-in workers on those complex machines.
Treating headcount as interchangeable is the fastest way to trigger a massive quality failure. The required strategy is a total reconfiguration of floor duties.
How does that work?
You actively prohibit emergency workers from executing tasks that rely on tacit knowledge. So no final inspection, no measurement-sensitive assembly, no batch separation.
Basically, any phase where a defect is invisible to the naked eye.
Right.
So what do they actually do? If they aren't running the machines, why are they there?
You assign them to highly visible, mechanically repeatable tasks. Moving raw materials from the loading dock to the staging area. Building cardboard pallets. Basic visual sorting.
Oh, I get it. You are stripping the floor of all the mundane work.
Yes. To free up your remaining experienced core employees, You pull your veterans off the forklifts and the staging areas, and you concentrate them intensely on the judgment-heavy, high-risk quality control stations.
That is brilliant.
You don't try to teach tacit knowledge in an hour. You protect the tacit knowledge you already have by consolidating it where it matters most.
And I imagine the stakes dictate a lot of this. Like in a facility manufacturing plastic lawn furniture, a lapse in judgment means a chair has a cosmetic scratch.
Sure.
But in a highly regulated environment like pharmaceutical manufacturing or a food processing plant handling deadly allergens, diluting that judgment creates a literal public health crisis.
A massive one.
A single mistake means cross-contamination, a massive FDA recall, and potentially lethal consequences for the end consumer.
Which is why the stakes in those environments require an entirely different caliber of external support. Standard staffing agencies simply cannot manage the compliance rigors of a pharmaceutical plant under crisis conditions.
So who does?
This necessitates specialized continuity partners. For instance, the source mentions Regional Supplemental Services, or RSS Inc., which operates specifically in this high-risk tier.
But how does a specialized partner actually execute this? Like, if RSS Inc. can't rely on standard recruiting timelines, how do they manifest highly disciplined labor overnight?
They don't recruit when the crisis happens. They maintain readiness.
Readiness?
Yeah, readiness is a measurable operational state.
Mm-hmm.
It means maintaining active shadow rosters of pre-vetted, pre-certified personnel who are willing to travel immediately.
Oh, so they already have the people lined up.
Exactly. It means having established logistical networks like contracts with charter bus companies and extended stay hotels already inked.
Ready to go.
Right. They possess the internal infrastructure to deploy management alongside the labor, so the client facility isn't burdened with supervising 100 new faces.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that level of readiness and specialized infrastructure has to be incredibly expensive.
It's not cheap.
I'm looking at this from the perspective of a plant manager whose budget is already strained by a massive disruption. Specialized crisis labor must cost double, maybe triple, the hourly rate of a normal temp.
At least.
So how does a CFO justify signing a blank check for premium labor during a financial bleed?
Because they are using the wrong mathematical formula. Plant managers are conditioned to evaluate labor based on the hourly bill rate.
Which makes sense normally.
Normally, yes. A premium rate crisis worker looks outrageous compared to a local temp. But during an emergency, the bill rate is a rounding error. The true metric is the financial impact of operational downtime.
Let's run the actual numbers on that.
Okay. Imagine an automotive parts supplier. If their line sits idle, they aren't just losing the profit on the parts.
Right. There are penalties.
Huge ones. Their contract with a major automaker might stipulate a $10,000 penalty for every minute the automaker's assembly line halts because of a missing part.
Wait, every minute?
Yes. That's $600,000 an hour in pure punitive damages.
Wow.
Add to that the cost of spoiled raw materials, expedited shipping fees to catch up, and the astronomical overtime paid to their exhausted core workers.
Okay, yeah. When you stack a $600,000 an hour penalty against a premium wage bill, the premium wage is essentially the cheapest insurance policy on the market.
Exactly. A lower-cost staffing provider who delivers workers late with improper PPE, who require constant hand-holding and cause a line stoppage, that is infinitely more expensive.
Because they just trigger the penalties anyway.
Right. The strategic calculation is never whether emergency staffing costs more than ordinary labor. The calculation is whether it costs less than total operational failure.
So what does this all mean? A facility recognizes the slow leak. They map out the math. They bring in a specialized partner like RSS Inc. They utilize visual modular onboarding, and they restructure the floor tasks to protect their core veterans. Have they solved the crisis? Like, are they bulletproof?
They have stabilized the crisis, but they are absolutely not bulletproof. Even a tier one external partner cannot compensate for a vacuum in internal leadership or culture.
I would assume bringing in an outside army actually shatters the internal culture.
It definitely can.
Like if I'm a 10-year veteran supervisor on a packaging line and half my team is suddenly replaced by a deployed strike contingency crew, the entire dynamic of trust and unspoken communication is just gone. An agency can't instantly manufacture institutional trust.
Which is why emergency staffing is merely a bridge. It is a continuity tool. It's not a substitute for internal workforce resilience.
So the company still has to do the heavy lifting internally.
Yes. For the external deployment to succeed, the facility must have brutal, uncompromising internal communication protocols already established.
Because if the core floor workers don't understand the chain of command with the new workers, the facility descends into chaos.
Exactly.
If a temp worker gets conflicting instructions from three different veterans, the line stocks.
Over-communication without structure causes confusion, and under-communication causes rumors. Supervisors need absolute clarity on who has the authority to assign tasks, how breaks are staggered, and what the daily production targets are.
Which requires planning.
A lot of it. This demands prior cross-training among the core staff, so they are flexible enough to step into those elevated quality control roles we discussed earlier.
And this has to be mapped out long before the sky turns dark.
Yes. The source outlines a specific decision matrix that facility leaders use to determine their required response level. It measures urgency, risk, and complexity.
Let's break down that matrix for everyone.
Okay, so if your urgency is measured in weeks, your operational risk is low, meaning mostly manual, unpowered support tasks, and your environment has minor regulatory complexity, a standard local temp agency might actually suffice.
But if your urgency is measured in hours, your risk involves hazardous chemical areas or heavy industrial equipment, and the complexity involves a heavily regulated FDA environment facing an aggressive labor lockout.
That scenario triggers the highest tier of the matrix. You require a full, advanced contingency deployment. The denser the risk profile, the more you rely on intense operational discipline, structured supervision, and unyielding safety controls.
It is a sequence of rapid, high-stakes structural adjustments.
Exactly right.
To synthesize our exploration today, emergency staffing is undergoing a radical evolution. It is no longer just a reactive panic button smashed by a manager when a facility is already underwater.
No, it's proactive.
Right. It is a highly engineered production continuity capability. Yeah. It's an operational muscle that must be developed, budgeted, and drilled long before a hurricane forms or a labor contract expires.
The modular onboarding, the strategic quarantine of tacit knowledge, the financial risk modeling, that entire architecture is the invisible safety net keeping our infrastructure intact.
The next time you see a massive winter storm paralyze an entire time zone, or a sprawling regional transit strike dominate the evening news, and yet, a few days later, your local pharmacy shelves are fully stocked with the exact medications you need. You are witnessing the physical result of this logistical choreography.
It's all happening behind the scenes.
Real time, behind concrete walls, keeping the mechanics of daily life turning when everything else freezes.
This raises an important question, though, and it's a structural paradox to consider before we wrap up.
Oh, where's the paradox?
We've established that during a genuine operational crisis, the only viable survival strategy is to aggressively strip away all repetitive, mundane tasks from your most experienced workers.
Right.
You ruthlessly prioritize their time, reserving their cognitive load strictly for complex judgment calls, quality control, and problem solving.
Because it's the definitive method for maintaining peak efficiency under crushing pressure.
Exactly. You maximize the value of their tacit knowledge. But if that hyper-focused, highly specialized structure is the absolute best way to maximize efficiency and survive a crisis, shouldn't production facilities operate that way on a normal Tuesday?
Oh, wow. That's a great point.
We treat this as an emergency playbook, but perhaps this kind of ruthless prioritization of human expertise is actually the blueprint for a much better, fundamentally superior everyday factory. Something to think about.